My name is Daisha Clay. I'm the audio librarian here at Classical 91.7. While I'm a real librarian, I have a deep, dark
secret.
I know very little about classical music. I grew up listening to rock. And I know something about jazz. But when it comes to classical... But I really want to learn. So, every week on this show, a classical music expert will give me a piece of classical music they think I should know. And then we'll discuss it. Come learn with me in the classical classroom. Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Classical Classroom. I'm Daisha Clay, and today my instructor will be Wesley Horner, who's been a guest in the Classical Classroom once before. Wesley is an independent producer. He is an author, a documentary filmmaker, a Peabody Award winner, and among his many resume entries, he's been an executive producer of Performance Today, and you helped develop From the Top, or do I have that backwards? You helped develop Performance Today?
I launched Performance Today. So okay. I was its executive producer in its first few years. Uh-huh. And From the Top, I produced all the pilots where we established the format, basically.
All right.
Although it's been significantly enhanced by my successors. A lot.
It's a great show.
Yeah.
Today, Wesley wants to teach me all about Beethoven's Seventh Symphony, but the second movement, because apparently the entire symphony is like an entire day long or something like that.
Well, it's not as long as that 3-hour Bach Mass we talked about the last time I was here. It's just 8 or 9 minutes, but something about this 8 or 9 minutes is so profound. And it's this second movement has just been part of my life forever.
Really?
And I think about it a lot.
When was the first time you heard it?
Oh, when I was a kid, my father had all these classical 78s from when he was a paper boy.
Uh-huh.
Back in the 1930s, I guess, something like that. And that's when I started listening to classical music, by listening to this old 78s.
Wow, that's pretty cool.
Those are actual physical discs you put in this machine and they go around in a circle.
I remember learning about 78s because 78s are different than like LPs, right?
They're smaller.
Yeah, because I had a record player when I was a kid and I was very into collecting records. And I accidentally picked up a 78 once and I was like, this is such a cool disc. It's like it's thick. And I'm going to take this home and I'm going to listen to, I think it was like Sarah Vaughan or Nina Simone or something like that. And I got it home and I was like, wait a minute. This doesn't work at all. Yeah.
So I got to know that piece.
Yeah.
And I latched onto it. It meant so much to me. And listened to it for years, memorized it. When you learn a piece of music without ever seeing the music, after a while, it's just in your head.
Mm-hmm.
Memorized it. And then one time in college, I was playing in the college orchestra, and we got to sight read it one day. Because that was part of the shtick for a college orchestra. You prepare pieces for concerts, and then you also learn how to just read things fast.
Well, and you played viola, is that right?
Okay. Yes.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Great experience, except you know what? You have to sit right in front of the trombones. Oh my God. You're relaxing, you're playing, and then you forget that they're there, and then all of a sudden, my God, out of nowhere, there's the trombones.
Did you ever get poked in the head with the
I kept my distance.
Slide.
And then there's all that,
smart man.
That saliva on the floor.
Oh,
the trombones leave there.
Trombones, the bane of...
I'm looking at our recording engineer, trombone player.
That's right.
Todd Hallslander.
So, tell me...
It's okay, Todd. I've gotten over it.
Tell me a little bit about Beethoven, because, amazingly, we've somehow managed never to talk about Beethoven. So, why don't we talk a little bit about Beethoven as a person and as a composer?
He crossed paths with Mozart, showed up in Vienna, in town, met Mozart. Mozart said, watch this guy. He's going to be good. And then Beethoven went back home to Germany. And when he came back to Vienna, Mozart had died. Mm-hmm. He was an astonishing performer. And in those days, you were pretty much a performer first and a composer second. Mm-hmm. And one of the reasons you would write music was so you would have something to play.
I see.
And make a little money because you'd write a piece of music and the publisher would pay you to publish the music and you would make some money that way. Mm-hmm. So he was known as a performer. And then, of course, his hearing started to get worse and worse and he had to stop playing. He was an amazing pianist, though, just like Mozart was.
Did he have, and I know that he famously lost his hearing, but kept composing music. Why did he stop playing, though he kept composing?
He stopped playing because he couldn't hear what he was doing. And he actually did continue to play while he still had a lot of his hearing, but he didn't know how loud he was playing or how soft. And they say that sometimes he would play so soft you couldn't hear what he was playing or play so loud that he would break the piano strings.
Right.
Now, to be fair, pianos in those days were a lot more delicate than they are now. But, yeah.
Yeah, okay.
So I guess he went inside his head, and his whole world was inside his head and what he created and left for us there.
Yeah, that's just so mind-boggling. And I mean, it kind of makes sense that he would, you know, he would continue composing because he had, you know, all those years to know the music and internalize the music. And
I guess some people might say, well, how did he write music if he couldn't hear it? Mm-hmm. But, you know, most composers, you don't sit at the stereotype is you're sitting at a piano and banging it out and writing it down on a piece of paper. But just, I think a lot of composers don't need to do that because you hear it in your head, you know how to write that down. Just like anybody's writing a letter, you're writing a letter, you don't need to say it out loud. You know that you put those marks on the paper and someone else can know what you mean by that.
Yeah. God, but to be able to do that with music, like to just be so intimately familiar with where the notes fall and to be able to put that down on paper without even being able to really test out how it sounds on an instrument. I mean, that's incredible.
Well, you know, he knew how it would sound. His experience and skill and everything else, his talent was so great by then that he knew if he put that little mark on the paper, it's going to sound that way.
Let's talk a bit about the Seventh Symphony. Do you know whether or not Beethoven was deaf or losing his hearing when he made this?
He was on his way.
Okay.
He wasn't losing his hearing significantly.
When he wrote the Seventh.
He wasn't completely deaf yet.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. And what is it that stands out to you about this? And we're going to have to hear it, I think, to But what to you, aside from just loving it personally?
It is one of the most profound melodies I've ever heard, the way it starts. Mm-hmm. And, of course, because it's in the viola section, it's got to be good.
Yeah.
And the symphony starts with this, that melody just holds all this combination of sadness and melancholy and longing. Mm-hmm. And, you know, if I could tell you in words how it feels, it wouldn't come close to how does it feel just listening to it.
Yeah, it really sticks with you. I think it's going to be stuck in my head at least all day. Why don't we go ahead and hear a little bit?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Those are the violas that have the melody.
Oh, yeah.
Now listen to what happens. A little quieter. The this is like such an intimate conversation.
Yeah. You really have to lean in.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And to me, music, when it really works, is a conversation.
Mm-hmm.
Two people who love each other very much are talking here.
Mm-hmm.
The violas have said their part. Now the violins are coming in with an answer to that conversation.
Mm-hmm.
A counter melody. It's like if I told you something and you said to me, yeah, I know what you mean. Here's how I feel about it.
Yeah.
These two groups talking back and forth to each other.
Yeah, this may sound kind of weird, but it just struck me that knowing very little about Beethoven's music, this music just sounds like I would think that Beethoven would sound. I don't know, there's something...
Interesting.
Something very serious about it, for lack of a better word.
That melody is getting passed around from one group to another.
Mm-hmm.
It's so singing.
Mm-hmm.
It's hard to not move.
We've come so far from where we started, that quiet
right.
conversation.
Yeah. Yeah. To me, it feels like how it feels when you're talking to someone you're very close to, and they just pour out their heart to you.
Hmm.
That's how this melody feels.
I like that.
And here's the reassuring part of it. This is, honey, it's going to be okay. I love you and we're together. And this is good. And then the wind section chimes in with their reassuring note.
What do you call this section? Because it's almost like a bridge.
I think it is like a bridge. It's going from one part to another.
Yeah.
Yeah. Maybe it's just my own experience of playing this, but this is one of those times when, you know, I memorize this piece and I had it in my head. And then one day we come into orchestra and the music is passed around, we all sit down, we're supposed to play it. And I already knew it.
Uh-huh.
I had been hearing this and acting it out in my head for 10 years by then.
Oh, wow.
So there was no struggle. You know, where am I going to put my fingers? How am I going to play this? It just flowed.
It's a very flowing piece, how it just sort of...
Now what is he gonna do?
Yeah.
That melody just keeps coming back in different forms.
Mm-hmm.
One of the beautiful things about playing in an orchestra, Dacia, is you have 65 people on the stage, and when it really works, which I think is, to be honest, not all the time, You have 65 other people, other souls that you're breathing together with.
Mm-hmm.
Truly connecting on some intangible emotional level.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess I had that experience playing this piece. It was one of those moments, one of those unforgettable moments when me and all my friends on that stage, we were truly breathing together.
Mm-hmm. That's a really interesting description of it, because so many of the people in the orchestra you're literally breathing rhythmically together.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
That must create such a connected feeling amongst the players.
It does.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's a sort of irreplaceable experience. I think that's when it's working. This is why mm-hmm. people play.
Yeah.
To get that high.
Yeah, yeah.
So you know what he's doing now. He's piling them on top of each other. The melodies are getting mm-hmm. faster and faster because people are starting to talk at once.
Mm-hmm. Now we're just yelling.
We are yelling.
Mm-hmm.
But it's still that melody.
It's passionate yelling.
Yeah, it's passionate. I heard that not so much as yelling as really bearing your soul.
Yeah.
I think Beethoven did that a lot, his music. He would fool you. He would introduce something that seems simple on the surface, and you get into it in a few minutes, and he's bearing his soul. And you are too, if mm-hmm. you're playing it. And if you're listening to it, mm-hmm. you're in on that experience.
Do you think that's what distinguishes Beethoven from other composers? People just... You know, I mean, he's one of the Mount Rushmore figureheads of classical music. Like, what is it that makes him that?
It's so tempting to say that a deaf guy with such enormous talent mm-hmm. had some key to opening the power of the universe that mm-hmm. the rest of us don't. Maybe that's true. Maybe his deafness and his being forced to move into an inner world connected him in some profound way with some deeper levels of the human soul
mm-hmm.
that otherwise might not have happened. So he had no... Did he have no restraint on just putting it all out there?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Possibly. That's kind of how I hear it.
Yeah. And do you think that's what people hear in his music that has just sort of situated him at the top of the heap, is that sort of soul bearing?
Yeah.
Yeah.
People want that experience.
Yeah.
I do.
Yeah.
So that's the end of that.
Yeah, there are a lot of composers that I've heard that the music sounds a little perfunctory. You know, it's lovely, it's fine, it makes sense. There are a lot of patterns going on that are very interesting,
yeah.
But there's not that sort of depth, the emotional depth to it.
Mm. And did you feel that?
Oh, definitely. Absolutely. It's very sort of gut-wrenching music. Like it's sort of gets into you while you're listening to it. Yeah,
it's pretty definitely. Haunting.
Mm-hmm. Yes, haunting. Good word.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's
sure. That's...
Just. I mean, one other thought. To me, music really starts with singing, with the human voice.
Uh-huh.
And if someone is writing like that Beethoven did in this piece, you know, of course, it's for an orchestra. It's all instrumental. I think it still has its roots deep down mm-hmm. in the human voice communicating.
Yeah.
And I hear it. I hear that melody as what it might sound like if someone was singing to me in my ear. I mean, really close to me, like whispering to me. This is what it would feel like. I've actually talked to some superstar musicians about that, and they think of music conductors, for example, as it's a form of singing, whether it's you're playing the violin or the piano, even, which is kind of seems counterintuitive because you're banging these little hammers out. But the object, if you're doing it really well, is to kind of echo, replicate that feeling of it coming out of your body and through your throat and making a beautiful singing sound. And this melody fits so well into that paradigm of being a song, a human utterance.
The way that you describe it as a story, a conversation between two people, really, to me, connects to that idea of the voice and music.
For this, in this piece, it's so obvious because this one melody is introduced, dum 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 dum, and then somebody else takes up that melody, and while they are, the reassuring counter melody comes in, ba-dee-dum, ba-dee-dum. It's almost like they're patting you on the head or stroking your cheek, you know, while you're baring your soul. So these two melodies are happening simultaneously, and it really feels very clearly to me like a sung conversation between two people.
I really appreciate you taking time out of your incredibly busy schedule to come on the Classical Classroom again. It was really nice to see you again.
It's great to see you, and it's great to talk with you about music on this level.
Yeah, I enjoy the hell out of it because I learned so much. But we're going to miss you when you go back to Cape Cod. It's been nice having you here.
Thank you.
Everybody, if you have a burning question about classical music that you'd like to hear addressed on Classical Classroom, send me an email at dclay@classical917.org. Or if you want to hear past episodes or explore resources related to our topics, go to classical917.org/classroom. Thanks for listening, and we'll catch you next time.